Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a caravan of Central American migrants, now 5,000 strong, heading north for the United States from Mexico's southern border, and speak with Adrienne Pine, a professor of anthropology at American University and author of Working Hard, Drinking Hard, on Violence and Survival in Honduras. She joins us to discuss Trump's wildly inaccurate tweets and cynical demagoguery blaming the exodus of migrant families from violence-torn Honduras and El Salvador on the Democrats and on George Soros for mysteriously funding the caravan. Trump is also raising the specter of terrorism, claiming that people from the Middle East have been sprinkled along with criminals inside the large group of migrants who are seeking protection in numbers from the Mexican criminal gangs and drug cartels who prey on these desperate refugees as they head north. We'll also look into the origins of this caravan, which is proving to be a pre-election gift to Donald Trump, who is rallying the Republicans ahead of the midterm elections with the catch cry of Kavanaugh and the caravan. Then we'll get an analysis of the consequences of Trump pulling out of the INF Treaty signed 30 years ago by President Reagan and former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, who has been sharply critical of the White House's move, warning that the U.S. withdrawal would reverse efforts made to achieve nuclear disarmament. Kingston Reef, Director of Disarmament and Threat Reduction Policy at the Arms Control Association, joins us to discuss the consequences of Trump's move and John Bolton's current trip to Moscow. Then finally, we will speak with Nadia Tolokonikova, an artist, political activist, and founding member of Pussy Riot, the recipient of the Lennon Ono Grant for Peace and the Hannah Arendt Prize for Political Thought. She is the author of the new book just out, Read and Riot, A Pussy Riot Guide to Activism. We will discuss her call for more activism in the U.S. to stop the drift in this country under Trump towards the kind of authoritarianism she and her fellow activists suffer under Putin after having been beaten and tortured in a Russian gulag for trying to perform a punk prayer in the Cathedral of Christ the Savior in Moscow. Mother of God, drive Putin away. And joining us now is Adrienne Pine, a professor of anthropology at American University and a self-described militant medical anthropologist who has worked in Honduras, Mexico, Korea, the United States, and Egypt. Prior to and following the June 2009 military coup in Honduras, she has collaborated with numerous organizations and individuals to bring international attention to the Honduran struggle to halt state violence in its multiple forms. And she's the author of Working Hard, Drinking Hard, on Violence and Survival in Honduras. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adrienne Pine.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And Adrienne, this caravan is now about 5,000 strong. It's just across the southern border of Mexico, heading north to the United States. President Trump has been tweeting out the most incendiary tweets at his rallies, wildly inaccurate. He's also engaged in the worst kind of demagoguery, blaming George Soros for financing this, blaming the Democrats for it happening, saying that this caravan is sprinkled with Middle Easterners, obviously raising the specter of terrorism, along with, of course, his usual insult to people south of the border that they're criminals. So let me ask you this, though, because I'm totally puzzled as why this is happening at this time, because it feels like an incredible gift to Trump. He's down in Texas today campaigning for Ted Cruz and beating the drum on this. And, of course, it is resonating amongst his base and in Texas. And it may obviously hurt the chances, if not kill the chances, of Beto O'Rourke getting elected. Do you have any idea of why it's happening at this time?
Yes, I think I can speak to both of those things. First of all, I agree from the perspective of the U.S. midterm elections and the ways that Trump is able to use this to rile up his base, it is indeed unfortunate. However, despite the fact that both Trump and many people within the Democratic Party are accusing They're saying that either Trump's people organized it or Soros organized it as a way of affecting the midterm elections or as a way of threatening our country, if you're using Trump's line. The fact is that this is self-organized. This reflects really what is an exodus from Honduras, in which hundreds of people have been leaving daily. And what they've discovered, what Hondurans have found, is that the journey is so incredibly dangerous that the best chance they have to make it either to Mexico or to the United States alive and well is by traveling in larger groups. And so people increasingly have started traveling in larger groups because what they have in Honduras is a genuine humanitarian crisis. These are refugees who have been leaving for a long time, and right now the caravan has made it visible in a way that Trump can take advantage of. But it reflects both Trump's policies in Honduras that have created this horrible situation, but also the policies of his predecessors, in particular Hillary Clinton's support for the military coup in 2009 as Secretary of State. So we've got long-running U.S. support for Honduran dictatorship that has now become unbearable for a majority of Hondurans.
So what's the role of the group Pueblo Sin Fronteras, People Without Borders, and also Bartolo Fuentes, a former Honduran lawmaker and social activist who apparently on his Facebook originally put out the call to show up at a bus stop in San Pedro de Sula, which is, of course, one of the most violent-stricken cities in Honduras?
Well, so first of all, the thing about Bartolo that they've been saying, he actually had not put out a call. What he had been doing was accompanying the group as a journalist. So he wasn't calling for people to join, but rather was publishing photographs of their journey on his Facebook page and on various websites to spread the word about what was happening, about the ways that people were sort of using their own agency to save their lives in Honduras. And indeed, San Pedro Sula is one of the most violent countries in the world. Honduras itself has one of the highest rates of homicide in the world, and in fact had the number one rate of homicide as measured by the United Nations up until the current president and dictator Juan Orlando Hernandez prevented further counting of the homicide rate. So it's likely that it still does have the highest homicide rate in the world. So Bartolo Fuentes was accompanying the group as a journalist, not as an organizer. And that's what makes it so concerning that he was abducted by Guatemalan police in the company of U.S. embassy officials while he was accompanying the group and reporting on them in Guatemala, and then held incommunicado until a habeas corpus was, several were filed for him by Guatemalan human rights group, and then deported to Honduras. So we have really grave concerns for his safety as a former lawmaker and journalist. The group Pueblo Sin Fronteras, to my knowledge, had nothing to do with the organization of this particular caravan. Pueblo Sin Fronteras did organize the caravan that made a lot of headlines in the spring of this year. But this is a caravan that was organized over WhatsApp groups, mostly by people in the San Pedro Sula region originally. Originally we're talking about 200 people, but very quickly thousands of people heard about it and joined on because these are people who were planning on leaving already, and they're doing so for their safety. I think the arguments on both sides that this is something that's organized to influence the U.S. midterm elections or to harm our country are absurd on the face of it. If you think that 7,000 people are simply going to leave their home and family and community on a whim to alter the elections in another country, it really falls flat.
And again, I'm speaking with Adrienne Pine, who is a professor of anthropology at American University and a self-described militant medical anthropologist who has worked in Honduras, Mexico, Korea, the United States, and Egypt. And Adrienne, obviously, in the rational world, the reasonable world, what makes sense is to find ways to make life more livable for the citizens of Honduras and El Salvador in particular, who are fleeing this gang violence and criminality that is rampant and rife. And, of course, as you mentioned, the current leader in Honduras is hardly legitimate. The election results were coming in. He didn't like them, and they suddenly – he disappeared them all electronically, which I guess is what the Secretary of State down in Georgia is probably going to try and do. He did it in the last by-election when he got rid of this Democratic challenger, John Ossoff. So that was pretty brazen. But Donald Trump, rather than do the logical thing, which is to find ways to make life more livable in these countries – he cut the funds that Obama had placed after the 2014 exodus from Central America. The Congress authorized $750 million in a package for the Northern Triangle countries back then. And in the fiscal year just ended, USAID Guatemala was $83.7 million to Honduras, $58.3 million in El Salvador, $50.7 million. And now in this fiscal year, Guatemala is slated for $69.4 million, Honduras $65.7 million, and El Salvador for $45.7 million. And those are trifling amounts of money. And, of course, Trump is now threatening to cut those amounts as well, cut them all together. So what do we do? I mean, is it just because we have this ignorant thug in the White House that we have no choice but to wring our hands in disgust?
Well, you know, I think the politics of aid are incredibly complex because it's ironic that Trump has been threatening to cut off the aid to the unelected dictator Juan Orlando Hernandez if he doesn't stop the flow of migration, which he has now done by militarizing the border, closing down the borders to Guatemala and turning the country into a virtual open air prison. It's ironic that Trump is threatening to cut off the aid to Juan Orlando when that's exactly what Honduran solidarity groups have been calling for all along, because that aid is not reaching the Honduran people. What that aid is being used for is strengthening the military security apparatus that is used for repressing the people. It's used for death squads. And at the same time as the public institutions, the education, the healthcare is just being slashed in Honduras, the hospitals no longer have medicines. They don't even have water or electricity in many cases, talking about the major hospitals in Honduras, and, you know, students can't go to school anymore. It's really a disaster. So, you know, when talking about how to support these countries and how to recreate institutions that can provide a brighter future for Honduran children and families, we have to go far beyond just talking about aid, but actually thinking about allowing Hondurans to have sovereignty again, which is something that the United States very actively helped to usurp from them in the 2009 military coup that our government strongly supported. So, I think our role, there's no way that our role in this crisis could possibly be overstated. The United States has been destabilizing this region and actively promoting genocide in Guatemala, using Honduras as a military base, promoting mining operations that are destroying the health and environment for people throughout the Northern Triangle of Central America. And we really need to go to be out of those countries in terms of that sort of intervention. And if there's any sort of support we should be providing, it should be recognizing our role in these crises and stopping the militarization on our borders and treating our Central American brothers and sisters as family.
So tell us what the connection is between the military dictatorship and the drug gangs, because as you mentioned, that the military are running death squads, and that's what's terrorizing the people. I also understand that these gangs that are in the drug trade mostly, and this is also true in El Salvador with the MS-13 and the 18th Street, both of which, by the way, were those two street gangs were created here in Los Angeles back in the 80s. But so give me an understanding of, is there collusion between the military government and the drug cartels?
Absolutely. And, you know, there has been for a long time, but this was significantly intensified following the coup in Honduras. Honduras is basically a narco state right now because that's the only place that and remittances are the sources of income in Honduras. Gangs are the hitmen for the military and the police who run their own cartels with the collusion of the politicians. And this is, it's not even an open secret. It's just open knowledge in Honduras. And, you know, the territorial control that cartels run on a large scale and then gangs run on a neighborhood scale prevents people from being able to carry out their day-to-day activities. It prevents them from having small businesses. It prevents them from walking safely on the streets. It prevents them from going to school. And that is effectively what's made it unlivable for them. And the U.S. is, of course, again, actively supporting this drug and extractive economy, just as it did in the 1980s when the CIA was using drug lords in Central America to fund the Iran-Contra operation.
So when you said earlier that, ironically, Trump cutting off the funds or threatening to do so, mm-hmm. he'd have to do it with the cooperation of the Congress, that's something that activists, human rights activists, have wanted because this money is going to the military and presumably, I mean, they're all in bed with the drug cartel. I mean, what does the DEA think of this? I mean, I know nobody's ever make the case that the war on drugs has been anything but a catastrophe, but I'm just wondering about whether there's anybody inside the United States government that are trying to talk sense to Trump, or is he just unreachable? And of course, if the Republicans win in a couple of weeks' time, then he'll be even more dangerous. But at this point, my understanding is that the only adult left in the room is Secretary of Defense Mattis, and he's about to be kicked out. So is there anybody that can speak sense to this guy?
Oh, I mean, I think that's another issue entirely. I don't think that anybody could speak sense to Donald Trump, no. But certainly the DEA is no ally in any of this either. The DEA is responsible for the execution and cover-up of a massacre in Awas of indigenous people in 2012 that was part of a sting operation that went horribly awry. And, you know, the DEA has at no point shown any interest in Honduran democracy, and none of the U.S. government agencies have. There have been a number of U.S. Congress members that have been strong advocates for cutting off military aid to Honduras and for an end to the repression in Honduras, including the dozens of, or the, I think it's around 14 at this point, political prisoners who are still being held for protesting against the electoral fraud in 2017, among them Edwin Espinal, who's a well-known human rights defender and worked closely with Berta Cáceres, who was murdered in a couple of years ago for her work against the dam that was being built by the company DESA that was going to dam the indigenous territory in the Rio Hualcarque. And, you know, so what you have is it's the most dangerous country for journalists, for human rights activists, and the only people in the U.S. government who care about it are U.S. Congress members in the Progressive Caucus by and large. And, you know, I think really what needs to happen is
massive pressure from the grassroots in support of these Hondurans who are fleeing for their lives. And that ties that, the fact that we have created this tragedy in Honduras, with the tragedy of concentration camps that the Trump government is creating for children on our own borders, and that sees the connection between those two phenomenon, and, you know, we need to be fighting in unison against them.
Well, just in closing, Adrian, what do you make of AMLO, López Obrador, the incoming new president of Mexico? He's called for the United States and Canada and Mexico to jointly form a fund to take care of the people in these countries and make life more livable, the very conversation we had earlier in this conversation.
You know, López Obrador is a ray of light in a very dark moment right now, and I hope that he keeps true to his promise to provide jobs and, you know, and protection for the refugees coming from Honduras. And that will be a really serious contrast from the way that the Peña Nieto government has been treating Honduran migrants, refugees, both, you know, tear gassing them with their national police, and then also holding them in basically open air prisons in the Feria Mesoamericana. So I think that, you know, his inauguration can't come soon enough, López Obrador.
But what about the fund? Is that a realistic step?
I think it's a great idea. I'd like to see it move forward.
Tell that to Donald Trump. I thank you for joining us, Adrian.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Adrian Pine, who's a professor of anthropology at American University and a self-described militant medical anthropologist who has worked in Honduras, Mexico, Korea, the United States, and Egypt. Prior to and following the June 2009 military coup in Honduras, she has collaborated with numerous organizations and individuals to bring international attention to the Honduran struggle to halt state violence in its multiple forms. And she's the author of Working Hard, Drinking Hard on Violence and Survival in Honduras. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with an analysis of the consequences of Trump pulling out of the INF Treaty signed 30 years ago by President Reagan and former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev.
I'm just a poor wayfaring stranger traveling through this world below. There is no sickness, no toil nor danger in that bright land to which I go.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kingston Reeve, who's the Director of Disarmament and Threat Reduction Policy at the Arms Control Association, where his work focuses on nuclear disarmament, preventing nuclear terrorism, missile defense, and the defense budget. He was previously the Director of Nuclear Nonproliferation at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation and Council for a Livable World. And he writes a monthly column for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kingston Reeve.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Donald Trump unilaterally pulling out of the INF, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which was signed, I believe, about almost exactly 30 years ago by President Reagan and former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, who's been very, very sharply critical of this move on the part of Trump. What I find extraordinary about it is, if there's a problem with the Russians, which what we're alleging over this Iskander missile that they've developed, by pulling out of the treaty, it doesn't do anything to bring Russia back into compliance with the INF treaty.
You're exactly right, Ian. The this decision to withdraw from the treaty, as President Trump announced over the weekend that he planned to take, would remove all constraints on the production and fielding of the illegal missile under the treaty that Russia has developed. And this would increase the threat to our allies and range of those missiles. A decision to withdraw also lets Russia off the hook for its violation of the treaty and would leave the United States holding the bag for the treaty's demise, and also create another source of division between us and our allies, who are still chafing from the Trump administration's decision to withdraw earlier this year from the Iran nuclear deal. So other than that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln, you might say? There's really no upside to withdrawing from the treaty, as you mentioned. It won't put pressure on Russia to return to compliance. It's only downside.
Well, I recall at the time when the INF Treaty was being negotiated that it was a heavy lift, because essentially the Russians or the Soviets had the SS-20 short-range missile, which is what we were trying to get rid of. But in retaliation, we were deploying the Pershing missile and the cruise missiles, both of which could reach Russian targets, the Pershing within 8 minutes, and the cruise missile, of course, since it hugged the ground, it would come in and undetected. And the Russians' position was, well, you, the Americans, as a part of NATO, you can strike us and destroy most of Russia, or most of our targets, but since they won't be coming from the United States, your nuclear arsenal is intact and your country is untouched. So on the surface, from the Russian point of view, there was a certain amount of sense to, logic to that, wasn't there?
Yes, as you outlined, a key reason why the INF treaty was agreed to in the late 1980s was that there was concern on both sides that the deployment of intermediate range missiles by the United States and NATO on the one hand and Russia on the other was particularly destabilizing because of the very short flight times of these missiles. They could reach Russian targets fired from NATO countries within a matter of minutes, and likewise reach European targets fired from the Soviet Union within a matter of minutes. So that was obviously nuclear weapons pose a significant danger, no matter the range of the weapons. But those intermediate range forces deployed in Europe were seen to be particularly destabilizing. And the removal and elimination of those systems has been a key pillar of stability in the Euro-Atlantic region for the past 30 plus years.
Well, my understanding is that the fear that the Russians had from the fact that the Pershing could strike Moscow and all their command centers within 8 minutes. You may recall at the time a light plane was flown in by a German pilot, a little Cessna, and landed in Red Square, which sort of gave you an indication of how good the Soviet air defenses were, that they instituted what they called the dead hand on their strategic nuclear forces, that essentially if any kind of nuclear attack would happen, no matter where it came from, an automatic dead hand would come into play and release the entire salvo of their thousands of nuclear missiles, mostly at American targets.
Right. I do recall that. And the Russians continue to express concern that U.S. missile defense launchers in Romania and soon in Poland could be used to launch offensive missiles and perhaps even missiles armed with nuclear warheads at Russia, in a replay of the concerns that Russia articulated during the Cold War. And certainly the U.S. withdrawal from the INF Treaty would do nothing to reduce Russia's paranoia in that regard. If anything, it will increase Russia's concern about such an attack, despite the fact that, in my view, we are not going to put offensive systems in those missile defense launchers in Romania and Poland. But the Russians nonetheless remain concerned about that.
Well, in terms of the defense budget, Trump is threatening to basically ramp up a program of bringing back intermediate range missiles, and starting an arms race, because he said this before, we have an arms race, we'll automatically win it. But, you know, you can make the case that, well, it's a fact, isn't it, that the defense budget as it stands today is higher than it was at the height of the Cold War when we had a real enemy. And, you know, the idea, are you going to add more to that when we've already got thousands of nuclear weapons is extraordinary. I mean, the fact that we went, what did we go down from, about 64,000 nuclear weapons to about 15,000? And the idea that we would reverse that trajectory is just mind-boggling.
Yes, we agree. As you just described, the Trump administration, in its nuclear posture review, a document outlining U.S. nuclear policy planning force structure and more, recommended developing two new types of lower yield nuclear capabilities above and beyond the hundreds of low yield nuclear weapons that the United States already possesses, designed to deter and counter Russia. In addition to those two additional capabilities, the Trump administration also requested funds in fiscal year 2019, about $50 million, to begin research and development on conventional intermediate range ground launch missile systems designed in particular to counter Russia's violation of the INF Treaty and to attempt to build leverage to pressure Russia to return to compliance. No decision has been made on what form that new missile system would take. But if President Trump makes good on his threat to withdraw from the treaty, I would expect work on such a missile system to accelerate.
So when President Trump says today to a group of reporters that the U.S. would increase its nuclear arsenal until other nations, quote, come to their senses, what do you think the chances of that happening are? I mean, no, the historical record is that this is just a tit-for-tat process. And once you start escalating, the other side escalates too.
Right. I mean, Russia and China aren't going to come to the table so long as the U.S. policy is to expand its nuclear capabilities and shun diplomatic efforts designed to limit and rein in those capabilities. In addition to stating that the United States will withdraw from the INF Treaty, the Trump administration has also not responded to repeated Russian offers to begin discussions to extend the 2010 New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or New START. And that agreement is the only agreement in force that currently regulates the deployed strategic nuclear arsenals of the United States and Russia. And that treaty is slated to expire in 2021 unless it is extended for 5 years as allowed by the treaty. The treaty limits U.S. and Russian deployed strategic nuclear warheads to no more than 1,550, still an enormous number, but a significant reduction relative to where the two sides were during the Cold War. And indications are that National Security Advisor John Bolton, who has been urging Trump to withdraw from INF, is also appears to be slow rolling an internal administration review of whether to extend New START. And like INF, Bolton has long been critical of the New START treaty as well. And if New START goes away and is not extended, and if President Trump does indeed withdraw from the INF treaty, there will be no constraints, legally binding constraints, on the world's two largest nuclear arsenals for the first time since the early 1970s, so in decades, which would add to the tensions that already exist between the two countries and greatly increase the risks of renewed nuclear competition.
Well, of course, Bolton is in Moscow as we speak. He met with Lavrov, the foreign minister, and Nikolai Patrushev, who's Putin's national security advisor and an uber hawk, I mean a rabid hawk. These two guys, Bolton and Patrushev, are absolutely twins. But just in closing, all we know so far is that in an interview on Moscow Radio's Echo Moscow, Bolton said that, quote, I told our Russian colleagues that their meddling in our election process had hardly had any effect. I just find that astounding. That goes back to Helsinki, where Trump, standing next to Putin, accepted Putin's version that he didn't meddle in the elections as opposed to his own intelligence services. Now they're doing it again. I mean, they're basically saying, well, they're not criticizing the Russians, holding them to account for meddling in our democracy. They're basically saying, well, you may have done it, but didn't have much of an effect. I just find that extraordinary. I mean, and I know it's not related directly to what we're talking about, but the attitude just is mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's not clear where Bolton is getting that, because as I recall, the U.S. intelligence community did not make a determination about what kind of impact the Russian attack had, although my view is that it did have had a significant impact. But, I mean, to bring the conversation back to the INF issue, a decision to withdraw on the part of the United States, as I suggested earlier, plays into Russia's hands, in my view. It lets Russia off the hook because it's Russia that has been violating the INF treaty. That violation is unacceptable and should result in a strong U.S. and NATO response. But the issue is what the smartest way about going about that is. And withdrawing from the treaty allows Russia to blame the United States for ending the treaty. And the United States will have much greater leverage to put pressure on Russia and attempt to convince it to return to compliance if it remains a party to the treaty as opposed to withdrawing from it.
Well, Kingston Reef, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Kingston Reef, who's the Director for Disarmament and Threat Reduction Policy at the Arms Control Association, where his work focuses on nuclear disarmament, preventing nuclear terrorism, missile defense, and the defense budget. And he was previously the Director for Nuclear Nonproliferation at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation and Council for a Livable World. And he writes a monthly column for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with Nadia Tolokonikova, the artist, political activist, and founding member of Pussy Riot. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Nadia Tolokonikova, an artist, political activist, and founding member of Pussy Riot. She is the recipient of the Lenin Ono Grant for Peace and is a co-recipient of the Hannah Arendt Prize for Political Thought. In 2013, after nearly 2 years in prison for singing a song protesting Vladimir Putin in Moscow's main cathedral, she opened the Mordovia office of Zona Prava, a prisoners' rights non-governmental organization, and later she started Media Zona, an independent news service, now partnered with The Guardian, and she is the author of the new book just out, Read and Riot, A Pussy Riot Guide to Activism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nadia Tolokonikova.
Hello, and I'm happy to hear you all. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Nadia. And at this moment, things are pretty bleak, needless to say. And the arms treaty, it's called the INF Treaty, that was negotiated between Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan 30 years ago, as now Donald Trump is now tearing it up. And I used to work on arms control with the Soviets on the SALT II treaty, and it's a particularly dangerous situation for the Americans to give up on an arms treaty, because we've never had in geopolitics before on the Russian side the combination of national security and organized crime, nuclear weapons, and the mafia. And it seems that we are, on our side, behaving very recklessly. Do you see us heading back into a new Cold War?
I think the problem that we never consciously got rid of the Cold War paradigm in the very first place. Because in my mind, when the Soviet Union so quickly collapsed, everybody just took it for granted, you know, this Francis Fukuyama's statement that it's the end of history. And so right now we can just relax and enjoy the capitalism and consumerism. But and so we kind of stopped our ideological work and the questioning, the very core of our political existence and of our existence as citizens of our countries. And this really important political, ideological work never was done. And it never was done in my country, where we are ruled by Vladimir Putin, who is an ex-KGB agent who's coming directly from the USSR and who never actually wanted to get rid of Soviet experience. But I'm afraid that a lot of American politicians, they're still trapped in this Cold War paradigm as well. And so until we will not think through all this experience, until we will not try to invent something else, we will never be able to establish new paradigm in relationships between our countries. Because, you know, the black and white world really doesn't work, and it doesn't help us to establish communication. And that's why I think in the times when mainstream politicians are failing to fulfill their duties to establish this communication between our countries, it's especially important for us as citizens and activists to reach out to each other, to share experiences and find, you know, an actual human background that can connect us and just pay less attention on the craziness that's going on in the mainstream politics, at the same time trying to get back the seats to us, because like we have to do something with this politics. We kind of just let it go.
Well, the fate of the world depends on it. But there is ideological confusion here in the United States. On the right wing, the Republicans are always the Soviet haters and the red baiters. And on the left wing, the liberals are now hoping that the CIA, who they always were suspicious of, finds the evidence to put Trump in jail. And I think there's no question the evidence is so overwhelming that Putin has some kind of hold over Trump. So what's extraordinary at the moment is that you have, even on the left in this country, you have people who support Putin. And on the far right with the Republicans, they also support him. On the left, it's pretty shameful that someone like Oliver Stone would make such a valentine about Putin at the same time not showing solidarity with the young Russians, who are the very people that we should be in solidarity with.
This position is pretty confusing to me. I was trying to talk with Oliver Stone about it, but he was just making love of my shoes and with hearts on them. And he said like something like, "Oh, why don't you go to dance? And why don't you go to just have fun instead of talking about this?" I met him just once, but we never had a chance to really discuss it. But I had a chance to discuss it with Julian Assange when we long time ago, before, you know, his accusations of sexual misconduct. It was like in 2014. We visited him in Ecuadorian embassy, and we asked him why does he support Putin, or at least he never said anything against Putin. And more or less his position is that any leader who is against the United States of America, and this leader is good to me, which is, in my mind, a little bit hypocritical position. And obviously, like talking about WikiLeaks, I would be so happy to see WikiLeaks' stuff on not on Hillary Clinton, but on Donald Trump as well. So I think like when you stand for democracy, when you stand for their freedom of information, you cannot really take the side of a person who eats humans like Vladimir Putin.
Again, we're speaking with Nadia Tolokhonnikova, who is an artist, political activist, and founding member of Pussy Riot. She is the recipient of the Lenin Ono Grant for Peace and is a co-recipient of the Hannah Arendt Prize for Political Thought. And she's the author of the new book just out, Read and Riot, A Pussy Riot Guide to Activism. Well, if Putin doesn't own Trump, and there's a lot of evidence from early money laundering when the coffers of the Soviet Union were looted by the KGB and transferred into Manhattan real estate via the sort of Brighton Beach Mafia, as they were called, there's an awful lot of evidence that there's a lot of compromise on Trump. And it does seem that Putin, basically, it was a win-win for him. If Trump would have lost the elections, which everybody expected, he would be going around the country holding rallies saying, lock her up, and dividing the United States. So the one thing that seems to have been exported from Putin's Russia to the United States is the state media that we have now with Fox News as the kind of the Pravda of the Republican Party. And Surkov, Putin's political technologist, he seems to have had a lot of influence here in the United States. We never had fake news until recently, and that seems to be an export from Putin. Have you noticed a similarity between Russian media and particularly Fox News here in the United States?
I honestly noticed it before. I don't think it's a unique situation with Trump. I think any news has their own agenda. That's why you're proud to be publicly funded radio, right? Like if you have a private owner, then the owner has some sort of influence on you.
Right. Well, that's
so
true.
I noticed it before that, not only with Fox News, but with liberal TV channels as well. Like, you know, as an anarchist and leftist, I have an eye on this kind of things. But I think what Putin did, he was able to spread his understanding of news, yeah, not only on the United States, but all over the world, because he is a pioneer of this post-truth attitude to news in the world politics. At least he's one of the pioneers, because he always says that there is no reality, there's just interpretation of reality. And I don't really remember. I'm not living here in the United States, but I don't remember people talking that much about relativity of any news and any information before Trump picked it up from Putin.
Well, there is that. I don't know when you saw the book by Peter Pomerantsov, where nothing is true and everything is possible, which is the sort of the idea of how they're holding up a black mirror to the West and accelerating hypercapitalism. I mean, we are in the process under Donald Trump of becoming a kleptocracy and even an authoritarian state. If he wins the election in little more than 2 weeks' time, and in other words, if the Democrats don't take the House, they're unlikely to take the Senate, I think we'll see a quantum leap towards a kind of imitation of what you have now in Russia. Do you think I'm being too dire and pessimistic?
I don't think you are, but for me, everything is in details. It's like when you talk about Democrats taking over the seats, like it's always question for me, like what kind of Democrats? Because I'm one of those who say that Democratic Party should be reformed and should be reformed by people like Bernie Sanders, because I don't really support Democratic Party of Hillary Clinton. So just in general, I believe that it's time for American citizens to move towards more leftist and progressive way of thinking that was introduced here on massive scale by Bernie Sanders, but right now I don't hear as much about it as I would love to hear. But I'm hopeful because I see a lot of young people who never was active, politically active before, but after 2016, after Trump's election, Trump's victory here in the United States, they became politically active and they're inventing new ways how to make politics exciting for them. And yeah, I'm hopeful that at some point this country will be taken back by progressive leftists.
Well, we celebrate our democracy in terms of what we call the separation of powers, where you have the White House, the executive branch, then the Congress, and then the judiciary. And at this point, Trump controls the judiciary, he controls the White House, and he controls the Congress. So even though I'm myself a friend of Bernie Sanders, and I would like to see more of Bernie's people, in fact, take over the Democratic Party. At the very least, you have to have some check against Trump. And at the moment, there is nobody, there's no institution that's stopping him because the Republicans have abdicated their responsibility in terms of the legislative branch. So that is the current situation we're in. So we have to be, I think, at this point, pragmatic and just, you know, hope that at least we get the opposition party into a situation where they'll have some power to check Trump, because he is about to fire his Secretary of Defense, who's the only adult left in his cabinet, and he's quite dangerous and quite reckless. And he obviously wants a war with Iran. So I see this situation we're in as a very, very dangerous and delicate time in our history.
Definitely. I'm not even trying to argue with you. Like, get out and vote, definitely. And then later you can make deals between one Democrats with another's. But yeah, definitely, get out and vote. I'm all for it.
So let's talk a bit about how you've sort of exploded on the international scene, as you will, on February the 12th in 2012 in the Cathedral of Christ the Savior in Moscow, where your punk rock band Pussy Riot launched into a song, a punk prayer, Mother of God, Drive Putin Away, and you were very quickly arrested. My understanding is that, oddly enough, you feel that that was one of Pussy Riot's least successful actions.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, in terms of the quality of our performance, it sucked badly, as we were able to perform it only for 40 seconds. And then the guards of this church approached us and they kicked us out. We weren't immediately arrested. We were arrested after 2 weeks. So it was a political decision coming from very above. Possibly Putin or Patriarch of Russian Orthodox Church or somebody else was involved in this decision. But in the church itself, nobody really cared about us. They just kicked us out. Yeah, but we didn't want to release it even because we thought that the footage is so bad. But somehow news started to spread. Somebody made a photo and we decided that we should be in control of the action, we should be in control of the footage. If the news about this action leaked, somehow we have to release it too.
Well, the more recent action you did during the World Cup, where dressed as the police, you stormed the field during the World Cup, that obviously, I mean, you went to jail after the performance in the cathedral, got a 2-year sentence, served 18 months, were beaten and tortured, and that clearly had a big impact on your life in terms of working for prison reform. But the more recent action, it seems to have led to the poisoning of your former husband. Was that Putin's retaliation?
We have different theories why Peter was poisoned, and one of them, and most plausible one, is the revenge for the World Cup action. Right, because Putin was there at the audience during that final match, and Emmanuel Macron and other world leaders and politicians. And so we believe that a number of really high-profile officials from Russian law enforcement system got in really big trouble because they let peace rights activists run onto the field. So it might be a revenge from them. But another possible reason is Peter Verzilov's investigation in Central African Republic. So in the summer of this year, three Russian journalists were murdered in a Central African Republic. And there were making investigation on the links between paramilitaries in Africa and Russian Putin's oligarch, Yevgeny Prigozhin. And it looks like Prigozhin may order this poisoning as well. So, and you never know, maybe it's a combination of both reasons.
Right. And Prigozhin, of course, the cook, runs the troll factory in St. Petersburg that were involved in helping with the Russian GRU, military intelligence, helping elect Trump and hack the DNC and Hillary Clinton's campaign director's email, etc. So Prigozhin is a pretty busy guy. But just in closing, back to the young Russians, that's where the hope is, surely, that they're sick of this kleptocracy, this crony capitalism of Putin and the Siloviki looting the country and distracting them and being more and more brazen, killing people, dissidents on foreign soil like Litvinenko and Skripal. And it's the same thing that Kim Jong-un did with his half-brother in Malaysia. It's the same thing that this character that Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, are so enamored with, the Saudi Crown Prince, MBS, has just done in Istanbul. It feels like the world is getting more and more criminal or criminalized. How do you see it?
I don't know. I think it was pretty criminal all the time. It's just a matter of our reaction to it. I think if we like to think that we are getting more and more progressive, then we have to fight it back. And, you know, maybe in the 17th century, it was perfectly fine to kill journalists. But, now we're claiming that we're living in the 21st century where we have freedom of speech and we have freedom of information, freedom of expression. So, yeah, it's time to fight it back. And as for young Russians, I mean, it's important to understand that there is no one thing as young Russians. You have all sorts of different types of thinking in the young Russians. But obviously, those who are oppositional, they are getting more and more loud. And we experienced a big backlash from Russian government towards this young Russians. They literally start to put kids in jail, like, you know, this case of Anna Pavlikova, their 17 years old girl who ended up in prison because she had conversations with her friends in McDonald's about politics. And recently we were somehow with her friends and family able to release her from prison. But she's still under parole. She turned 18 years old in prison. And definitely it is an attempt to intimidate those young Russians who are sick with kleptocracy. Right.
Well, let's end on that note. And I thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And we've been speaking with Nadia Tolokinnikova, an artist, political activist, and founding member of Pussy Riot. She is the recipient of the Lenin Ono Grant for Peace and is a co-recipient of the Hannah Arendt Prize for Political Thought in 2013 after nearly 2 years in prison for singing a song protesting Vladimir Putin in Moscow's main cathedral. She opened the Mordovia office of Zona Prava, a prisoners' rights and non-governmental organization. And later she started Media Zona, an independent news service now partnered with The Guardian. And she's the author of the new book just out, Read and Riot, A Pussy Riot Guide to Activism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Graham Fitzgibbon and Kathleen Ash. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.